Beruchim Abayim Rabotai. Welcome to another edition of our Wednesday night class. Tonight we're studying Parashat B'Shalach. I'd just like to make one point on this Parashah. It's the Parashah where the Jewish people begin to make a living, to make a Parnasah. Jewish people at the end of the parasha start getting the man. Now the man was their form of paycheck. It used to come every day from heaven, and it used to land in front of their doorsteps or near their homes, and they had to go out and collect it. So that was their form of going to work. There was no other industry in the midbar. That's the way they made their living. They went, they collected the man, They processed it, and they ate it. So from the man, we learn many lessons in the guidelines in making a living. The whole concept of having to go to work is a difficult thing to swallow for many people. Work, according to the Torah, is a curse. Yeah, you knew that already. It's been said that work is a four-letter word, which means in the perfect world, Adam and Eshon did not work. It says the angels roasted meat for him and fed him wine, and he just was free to learn Torah, do mitzvot, and get close to God. After he eats from the tree, so then already the whole world order changes, and God says, "Bezeat apecha tocha lachem." That with the sweat of your brow, now you'll have to toil in order to make a living. And the Gemara says, so difficult is it to make a living, kasher parnasato shel Adam kekiryat Yam Suf. That it's as difficult as it was in the splitting of the sea, that's how difficult parnasah is. Now, of course, nothing is difficult for God. We're not going to say the splitting of the sea was posed a difficulty for Hashem. It just takes a second for him to split the sea, less than that. So what does it mean? It's difficult to make a parnasah like the splitting of the sea. The explanation is that when the Jewish people were leaving Egypt, and the Egyptians are chasing them, and they have the Yam Suf on one side, and the Egyptian army on the other side, and you have snakes and scorpions on the right and left of them in the Midbar. So the Jewish people were trying to think, how are we going to get out of this mess? So the options that they came up with, number one, surrender. There was a group that said, just let's go back to Egypt. There's another group that says, let's fight. And there's a third group that says, let's go into the Midbar. And the snakes and scorpions, God will make a miracle for us. And the snakes and scorpions will die. Just like God made miracles for us in Egypt. But nobody thought of the fourth option. Nobody dreamt in their wildest dreams that the sea was going to split into 12 lanes and the Jews were going to be able to leave. That didn't enter their minds. That was the most improbable scenario possible. And that attitude of the Jewish people when they saw the sea split, they probably were shocked. What? For this? Who thought this? That we're going to walk through Yam Suf. Thousands of gallons of water. I mean, it's impossible. But that's the same attitude that many people have when they go to work. It's very anxiety-filled trying to make a living because you don't know where you're going to make the living from. Even if you have a job, and even if basically your business is structured where you know exactly what you have to do to make the money, but it's not always so clear how you're going to make the money. And then all of a sudden you see you're putting your efforts over here in one area, and somehow something else comes up that you didn't even think about, and that's where it came from. And now the money's coming from a blind spot, from somewhere that a product that you got, by the way, is a secondary item, and all of a sudden that becomes your bestseller. And that's how it is every day in business, like Kiryat Yam Suf. You know, it comes from the place where you least expected it, And all of a sudden, that's where the Berakah comes from. Now, there's no question about it. Everybody in life is looking to be successful. Whether it's success in making money, whether it's success socially, whether it's success intellectually, everybody's looking to make success. One thing is clear. Success comes only from God. Ki hu anoten lecha koach la'asot chayil, the pasuk writes. God gives us the ability to be successful, and He controls the entire world. And in truth, one should have to only put his faith in Borei Olam and pray to Borei Olam and put his whole being in God's hands and a total reliance on his Creator, and that should be enough. But then they throw in this concept of hishtadlut, which makes things complicated. Hishtadlut means you have to be industrious. I wouldn't have a problem if you told me you have to have faith in God and everything is from God. Good, that's enough for me. Now I'll sit home and I'll open up a Tehillim book and I'll read it from cover to cover all day long. I have no problem with that. 150 perakim back and forth. I'll pray the Amidah 6 hours a day. My faith will be totally in God, and that's it. I'll go to the mailbox at 2 o'clock when the mailman comes and expect a check for a certain amount of money, and I expect gold bullion on my porch, and I expect, all means of success. Because that's it. You told me it's all from God. So I don't want to interfere with God. I don't want to get involved. I don't want to mess it up. God knows how to run the world. Doesn't need me to help Him. So we should have a system where the ingredients for making a living is faith plus faith plus faith equals parnasah. But then the rabbis throw in this concept called hishtadlut. No, you got to go to work. You have to make an effort. You have to be industrious. Even by the man, we see this. The man, no matter how much you collected, everybody ended up with the same measure per person. But the Torah says, try to collect the proper amount. Why would I have to collect the fish? If it's I'm doing it now, I go out, I just put one morsel of man in the basket, and I know, I take it home, boom, presto, it's going to turn into the right shi'ud. Why have to even try to get the right amount, and then God will, measure it out perfect? And Rav Samson Farler says, because the Torah is teaching you, you have to be industrious. They don't want you to just go out and be lazy and take the cop out way, put it in your basket, and then just rely on the miracle. You have to put an effort and work. And then the question is, why? Why work? Why not have all faith, no work? It's a fair question. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Shekonei Al Baro. So the rabbis give 3 basic reasons why we have to be industrious. It's interesting to note, animals do not have to make a hishtadlut, an effort to make a living like men do, or humans do. I don't know too many animals that work 9 to 5. They don't have jobs. An animal just has to seek its food, however long it takes him to find his food, and then he just hangs out for the rest of the day. And Borei Olam provides for them. Noten libhema lachma libnei olam asher yikrau. It's very easy to be a yak or a moose. They eat and they have the rest of the day for recreation. They don't have pressure. They don't have stress, they don't have cholesterol, they don't have high blood pressure. That is limited to human beings. So the question is, a plant. What does a plant have to do to exist? Nothing. Walk into your backyard, it's just standing there. Stands there all day, idle. And it gets rain, and it gets sun,
and you know, the God that comes and takes care of it. A plant has no eshtedlut at all, and it exists. So you come to wonder and say, you know, we got the short end of the stick here. You know, plants do nothing. The rain just falls by itself. The air just flows down. So humans can only exist by exerting an effort. Question is why? Why did God make it that way? So the Chovot HaLevavot, in his classic chapter called Shara Bitachon, goes through different reasons why we have to go through this process called work. One of the reasons he says is because at work, in the workplace, we can show our loyalty to God. It's a venue where we're tested every moment. Should we cheat or shouldn't we cheat? Should we be honest or should we lie? There's halachot in buying, there's halachot in selling. There's laws in plowing, there's laws in reaping. Every move that you're going to make in business is probably restricted somewhere in halacha in exactly how you do it. Interest, borrowing, lending. And therefore the business place, the marketplace, is a perfect venue, like I said, to show your loyalty to God. And that's why God puts us in there. To test us, to see if we'll do good or not. It's like the man itself. If you remember the man, there was many laws said about the man. You weren't able to leave over any man from one day to the next. You were not able to collect the man on Shabbat. There were certain laws. And that teaches us that the reason why God makes us go out for parnasah is to see if we'll rise to the challenge in acquiring it the right way. Some people have a prayer that they say, Arachamanu yifannithenu bechabod velo bebizui, beheter velo beisur, benachat velo besaar. In Birkat HaMazon they pray, God, please give us a parnasah, benachat, give it to us easy, and give it to us beheter velo beisur. Give it to us in a permissible way and not in a forbidden way. Don't test us where we're going to have to compromise in order to make a living. In truth, somebody that has faith in the marketplace would never disregard a mitzvah for the sake of the gain. I repeat, he would never disregard a mitzvah in order to gain. Meaning, mincha in the office is a very challenging task. You're in the middle of the workplace, you have meetings, there's phone calls. The normal guy says, I'll pray mincha later, he pushes it off, and it usually turns into arvit shtayim, and then that becomes a common practice. But the person that understands that the whole purpose of work is in order to show your loyalty to God, so you went to work to pray mincha, you went to show that prayer is the main thing and work is the side thing. And therefore, if it's a choice between doing a mitzvah and maybe having to lose a little, so a person that has priorities focused correctly will not make that mistake. The second reason why you go to work is because it wears you down. It tires you out. That's a good thing. Person gets up early in the morning, and he's got to get on the train or in the car, and he's got to get to work, which is a stressful thing in itself, and then he's got to work the whole day, and then he's got to get home, and then he's got to eat, and by the time he's finished all that rigorous schedule, so he's too tired to make sins. His friend calls him up and says, let's go out and make avonot. And he says, I love to make avonot, but I'm too tired to make avonot. I can't move. And I have to wake up tomorrow morning again at 6 o'clock because I have work again. And therefore, the rabbis tell us work was given to human beings because if they had a lot of free time, so they'd get into trouble. The boredom, the idleness would just lead to mischiefness. And when you get into mischief, then already there's trouble and there's problems. So it's to fill your time. One rabbi said, he used to tell his son, if you have nothing to do, break the door down and then fix it again. Just to keep busy. If you notice, and the statistics tell you, in the summer, crime always goes up. Because the children are out of school, they have nothing to fill their time with. They're bored. And therefore, you know, they steal cars, they graffiti, they get into trouble. So the Torah is telling you, in order to limit the damage of the Yetzer Hara, go to work. Be industrious, be busy. Now, based on those two reasons, there's a third reason I'm going to say in a second, but based on those two reasons, if a person is a high-level tzaddik, where, let's say, he proved his loyalty to God. He's a very religious man. He's pious. He keeps all the mitzvot with all the stringencies and all the all the halachot. So he doesn't need to go to work to show God that he's loyal. He's doing everything else. He's praying and he's learning and he's careful with everything. So what does he need to go to work for to show God that he's faithful? The Hafetz Chaim doesn't need to go to work to show God that he's religious. He has proven himself already. And if you have a great tzaddik, then let's say in every spare time he has, he's learning, or helping, or doing chesed, or praying. So he doesn't have to worry about his yetzer hara catching him during hours that he's not at work, because he's always busy, he's always learning, he's always doing something good. So a guy like that technically doesn't have to go to work. A guy like that technically does not have to make an effort. If the whole reason for the effort is, again, to tire the guy out so he doesn't have free time to make sin, and to show his loyalty to God in the workplace that he's doing mitzvot, but a person could show that outside the workplace that he's good. That's what the Hafetz Chaim only worked a half hour a day. You'd open the store for half hour, and after you finish, you close the store, and you go home, and you learn the rest of the day, you do whatever you have to do. Now, there's a third reason. The third reason why you go to work, Rabbi Dessler writes, he says, to make it look like a natural process. Because God does not do open miracles. Even in Mitzrayim, when they made Kiryat Yam Suf, if you remember, God had the wind the whole night before. An easterly wind was howling over the Yam Suf. Why does he do that, God? Make a wind the whole night before. So the next day when the sea splits, Paro says, it wasn't a miracle, it was the wind. He could blame it on natural occurrences. And even though the wind doesn't make a Yam Suf into 12 lanes, you know, with paved marble and apple trees and water, but okay, it's enough for Paro to hang his hat on. So what would be if a person would just sit back all day long, not do anything, and all of a sudden, you know, like I said, gold bullion would fall on his porch? So it'd be an open miracle. Then everybody would say, there'd be no free will anymore. God doesn't do that. So in order to hide the miracle of Parnassah, he tells you to go work. So now it looks like as if you did something to bring the Parnassah. You really didn't. It's all God. But it's to cover it up, it's to conceal it. That's why there was one rabbi called Rav Zundel. He held that for him, and this is only for him, it's enough to buy a lottery ticket. Because there are people that win the lottery. It's not a miraculous thing if you win lottery. And therefore he said, if the whole thing is that I have to make a shtadlut, is to make it look natural, so if God wants me to make the panasah, I bought the lottery ticket. That's my shtadlut. Again, for us, that obviously would not be the measure of ishtadut for us to do. You see, that's where it gets tricky. There's no answer to this question. How much should I work a day? Faith, you can never have enough faith, let's say. But effort. 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours, Sundays, Saturday nights, Chol HaMoed, how much work, Rabbi? I don't think anybody can answer that question, because it's not a set formula. It's not like the cycle of the moon, 29.5432. It's not like you can tell a guy, you have to work 6 hours, 32 minutes, and 42 halakim. There's no set measure. Everybody according to his betachon. The more betachon you have, the less effort you have to make. The less betachon you have, the more effort you have to make. That's basically the rule. I'll give you an example. There was a king called Hizkiyah Melech. Hizkiyah Melech was a great tzaddik. In his time, there was such a renaissance of Torah that you went from the north of Israel to the south of Israel, you couldn't find a child that was not fluent in all the laws of Tumah v'Tahara. That's Hizkiyah Melech. He took a sword and he put it in the middle of the Beit HaMidrash, and he said, anybody that doesn't learn Torah will be killed by the sword. Which means in his time there was a tremendous amount of learning. It was a great period. Hizkiyah Melech took the doors of the Beit HaMikdash and he sent them to the king of Aram. He bribed the king of Aram. He didn't want to have war against him. So he said he bribed him. The Navi's against him for doing that. The Navi held that was too much effort. He should have trusted God. Another time, there was a certain river in Jerusalem called Gihon. He went and sealed the river of Gihon in order that the armies of Sanhedrin should not come and have a water supply. And therefore, it's like a strategy in order that the foreign armies will not be able to attack. The rabbis were against him. Against him. What do you want him to do? He's the king. Aren't you allowed to make strategy? Aren't you allowed to, like I said, be industrious? Aren't you allowed to? He's got to make a shtetlut. Does he have to make an effort? What? He should just keep the water supply open, let the king of Aram come in when he has a chance to bribe him. Why is he guilty? And the explanation is because Hizkiyah Melech, you're not a regular person. Your level of bitahon is so great that when Sanhedrin had 180,000 soldiers knocking on the door of Jerusalem, you told your armies, go to sleep. And your armies woke up the next morning after a rested night, and all the soldiers of Sanhedrin were dead. So a man that has so much faith in God, for him to even make the smallest amount of effort, not necessary, too much, avon. Now, if we were to do that, it would probably not be enough. But you only sealed the waters of Gihon up, that's not enough. You should have drained it. You only sent them two doors of the Beit HaMikdash. You should have sent them the whole Beit HaMikdash. You should have put the Beit HaMikdash on the track, the trailer, and sent it to him. Because our faith has to be consistent with our ishtadlut. But since Hizkiyah's faith was beyond comprehension, as we saw in the war against Sanhedrin, so therefore you proved yourself already. So therefore you can't now all of a sudden be inconsistent and start doing more effort than for your level is called for. Yosef HaSadiq is in prison. Yosef tells the butler, do me a favor, don't forget me. Everybody's screaming, don't forget me. How does he tell the butler that? God says, 2 more years. Zechartani, Kim Zechartani, Kim Zechartani. Told 2 words, remember me, remember me. God says, hey, told they remember you? 2 more years in jail. Why? Because Yosef didn't have bitachon? Nah. Because Yosef had so much bitachon that even that was considered too much. You didn't need to go now rely on a goy who's not trustworthy, who is probably not going to help a Jew. So that's like you panicked. What did you need to do that for? It wasn't necessary to go that far in Yosef's level. Now for us,
if we wouldn't have solicited the Sarah Mashkim, God would say, what would you do? You had a chance. I sent you to God. I sent you to Shaliach. I sent you the messenger to get you out of prison. And you went and said, no, bitahon, bitahon. But for Yosef, yeah, it's guilty. There was a king of Israel called Asa. Asa was the king of Yehuda. In his time, there was a king of Israel. His name was Baasha. Baasha was fighting Asa. He was building this big type of fortress called the Ramah, where it would be very difficult for Asa to penetrate. And then Baasha made a deal with the king of Aram, and Aram accepted the deal. Now Aram and Baasha are going to go fight Asa. What does Asa do? He bribes the king of Aram, and the king of Aram breaks the alliance with Baasha, and now Baasha is forced to retreat, and Asa is victorious. The Navi has claims against Asa. What would you need to do that for? You have to go and bribe the king of Aram? Why don't you have trust in God that God can handle it for you? Now again, we say strategy, tactics, he's a king, it's responsible. You're right. For us, that would be the normal thing to do, but not for Asa. Why? Because the Navi tells us that Asa once had a war against the king of Cush, the king of Ethiopia. And in that army of Ethiopia, how many people were there? The Pasuk says, Elef Alafim. 1 million. 1 million Ethiopians. The 1 million man march. That's the source of it. And they sent 1 million of these guys against Asa, and Asa had a small army. And he turns to Borei Olam and says, Borei Olam, you can do anything. They have 1 million, we have a couple of thousand. Doesn't matter. God, there's no such thing as statistics. There's no such thing as numbers. The doctor says you only have a 10% chance to live. The person that has faith in God says 10% means nothing. If God wills him to live, he'll live. If not, not. It's got statistics have nothing. We can still pray and it can change. And sure enough, Asa beat them all. He killed 1 million people. So God says, a man that has faith to take a small Jewish army against 1 million soldiers, so you had no right sending the king of Aram a bribe. For you, it's too much ishtadlut. It's inconsistent with your faith. It was minimal ishtadlut, but it was too much for them. At the end of his life, they also have a claim against Asa. Asa got sick. So what did Asa do when he got sick? The biggest avon. He went to a doctor, it says. And the Navi comes to, well, you went to the doctors. You have no right going to the doctor. But the Torah says you're allowed to go to a doctor. Says the Ramban, a man on such a level that knows everything is from Borei Olam. In the olden days, you didn't go to the doctor. You went to the local prophet. Guy got a stomach ache. You know it's from God. So you went to the prophet. Why am I getting this stomach ache? That's because you ate something that didn't have the highest level of kashrut on it. And your tikkun is to do this and do that. And go to the mikveh. And, you know, say this pasuk 16 times, frontward and backward. They understood everything had a spiritual reason for it. But we're not on that level. We get sick, a Tylenol, a Robitussin, antibiotic. But Asa, you shouldn't have went to the doctors. So it's all depending on your level. I'm sure if Asa would have bought a life insurance policy also for his family, they would have had claims against him also. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says that for a regular person living today in the world to buy life insurance, it's not a lack of bitachon. For us, it would be considered sensible. Person has a family. Person has to be concerned. God forbid something should happen. Who's going to support the children? It's a sensible, logical reason. You're not doing something crazy. It's not something that's, you know, far-fetched. It's due diligence. And it's not considered a lack of bitachon. For us. Because we work 8 hours a day. But for the king Hezekiah, if he would go now, if they got an insurance policy, there'd be a claim against him. They don't even want him to, you know,
stop up a river in order that the foreign enemies will drink, because you don't have to do that. So you see already there's a correlation between Bitachon and Ishtadlut. But it amazes me when the Jewish people were leaving Egypt. So they have the Yamsuf on one side of them, they have the Egyptians on the other side, as we said. Snakes and scorpions on the other sides. And Moshe Rabbeinu sees the Jewish people, they were scared. Rightfully so. Scary just thinking about it. And what does Moshe tell the Jewish people? Vayomer Moshe, al tirau. Don't be scared. Don't be scared. I'm not allowed to be scared in this situation? Isn't it natural to be scared in such a situation? I mean, these people don't want to die. They don't see a way out. I mean, you're doomed whichever way you go. And there's a guy in a boat, and the boat is sinking. Sinking. Well, it's going down. It's going down. You're still on the boat. It's sinking in the middle of the ocean. And the rabbi comes on the boat. Nobody be scared. But nobody's scared. What do you mean nobody's scared? Nobody's scared because we're going to die in a couple of minutes. Don't be scared because we're all going to Olam Haba. Don't be scared because they're going to say Kaddish for us. What do you mean don't be scared? What do you mean don't be scared? We're scared. We don't want to die. So Moshe Rabbeinu is coming and making it out. Please. You're not allowed to be scared. You tell me why. And if somebody in that situation was scared, he made Avon. We're human beings. Guys on a plane, the wings come off. That's it. The plane's going down. No wings. Rabbi gets on the thing. Please, Abotai, we know if you look out your windows, there's no wings. But please, nobody be scared. Atirao. Atirao, what are you talking about? Atirao. You're allowed to be scared. There's no way out. It's not going to grow new wings. The boat is not going to all of a sudden patch itself and float. So the answer to that question is, you're right. Under normal circumstances, that's a case where you can be scared. But in the case of Yetziat Mitzrayim, the reason why it's not justified is because God told them everything will be okay. Once God tells you everything will be okay, that's it. Now, that'll never happen to us because we don't have any more direct communication with God. But Moshe Rabbeinu, once he got the green light from God, that God told him everything's good, then it's everything's okay. I don't have to worry about it. So if Eliyahu Nevi would come on the plane without wings, and he'd prove himself, he'd identify himself, he'd take out his card, it says Eliyahu Nevi, and you know it's Eliyahu Nevi, you believe him. And he says, there's nothing to worry about. Then at that point, if you worry, you're making avon. Because that's a guarantee from God himself. That's why when Borei Olam, or Moshe tells the Jewish people, don't save any of the man for the next day. Now, normally, without Moshe Rabbeinu telling him that, you're allowed to save man for the next day. It makes sense to do that. You're not allowed to rely on a miracle. Who says there's going to be man tomorrow? I have children to feed. I have a responsibility as a parent. There's money to be made today. I'll make for today, and if there's a little extra, save it for tomorrow. Don't we do that? We go to work. What, the second you make exactly what you need, you tell the boss, I'm going home? Of course not. You make a little extra, there's savings for a rainy day, for future endeavors, etc. IRA accounts, already we have to set ourselves up for the next 100 years, that already our grandchildren should have endowments, and then we're good. Now that might be an exaggeration, but that's considered for us normal ishtadlut. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to the Jewish people, no. Do not leave over any man till tomorrow. Do not take any... eat whatever you want for today, but don't save any. And the explanation is the only reason why that's acceptable is because God told him to do that. So when that comes from a tzivui from Borei Olam,
then already there's nothing to worry about, there's nothing to be concerned about. But like I said, in most cases, that's considered due diligence. Now, somebody once asked, how do you know how much bitachon you really have? What's the litmus test? Is there a test you could take to know how much faith you have? So the rabbi answered like this. You have a meeting with Walmart. This is the most important meeting you can have. They buy, you're a millionaire. They don't buy, so it's back to the drawing table. Now, of course, you prepare for the meeting, you prepare the presentation, you prepare the sales pitch, the item, what you're going to say. Everything is prepared to the T. And that morning, of course, you're going to make an attendance to synagogue. Because part of your preparations is to pray. But the prayer is not the main thing. And therefore, in the Amidah, when you get to that beracha, you tell God, please God, I need your help. But it's not that you believe that it's God. You're going to do everything. You just need God to be there with you as you do your thing. Well, you know, Jews, we get God involved also. It's like a sigula, maybe it's like a mazal thing. It's like good luck. But we really don't believe that it's God. I mean, at the end of the day, you prepared, you went, you made the item, you pitched it, you sold it. So it's like perfunctorily. You're just going through the motions because, you know, you were told to enlist God's help. And then what? In the middle of the prayer, you want to get to the meeting. So you leave early. Now, if you were at Walmart, would you rush through that meeting? The guy's sitting in front of you. Would you tell the guy, well, listen, could you make it fast? Like, I got to go in 10 minutes. Where are you going? This is it. This is the game, man. This is what you live for this meeting. You're going to rush the guy? At better. Let's say you have an appointment that night. In the middle of the meeting, you're going to tell the guy, listen, you don't mind if I change when we have this meeting. I got to put on a tuxedo. And as you're standing there, you start undressing, and you thought, yeah, I have this item. Excuse me for a second. Could you pass me my cummerbund for a minute? Okay, man. So what are you showing the guy at Walmart? That this meeting is not really important. It's whatever you're doing after is important. So a guy comes to the synagogue, and he doesn't have time for the synagogue. So as he's talking to God, he's undressing, he's taking off his tefillin, he's making himself a bagel, and he's running out. So what is he telling God? You're not the main item over here. You're not the main factor in what's taking place. The more important things outside the synagogue. That's a prayer that doesn't have already the level of bitachon. True bitachon, you say, it's happening here. Here's where the results are made. The results are going to be made through my tefillah. God right now is going to decide the fate of what's going to take place. I have all the time for this. Everything else is just going through the motions. So really, your attitude in prayer is a good litmus test to know if you were really a Baal Bitachon or not. Now, they tell a story of a little village in Europe, and somebody got sick. So they called a great doctor from Vienna to come. So the doctor's walking into the house. There's an old religious lady next door. She's the doctor walking in the house. So she tells him, what's going on? So one of the children are sick. So he tells them, you people went crazy? You're relying on miracles? Open a Tehillim book. In the old country, they understood that going to a doctor was considered relying on miracles. You have a much more obvious solution.
Open a book. Well, you guys went, you flipped out. You have a chance to open a Tehillim book and talk to God. You went now, you went to a doctor. That's old time thinking. But that's the same attitude that you have to have to an extent when it comes to your tefillah. Now, somebody asked exactly how prayer works. It's worthy just to, and I'm just rushing a little tonight because I have an appointment, but it's worthy to figure out how this concept of prayer works. Guy's not making a living. Who decided him not to make a living? God. So why should prayer change that? We had to come to God, please God, I want a living. I decided that already. Well, what? When he sees us praying, what does he say? Well, you seem like a nice guy. Okay, I'll change my mind. So the rabbis explain it like this. Chavot HaLevavot writes, whoever you put your faith in, God will put you in the hands of that thing. If you put your faith in your boss, God says, fine, I'm out. Go see how far your boss can get you. Go see how much you can accomplish. See what he can do for you. But I'm out. You put your faith in money, God says, fine, let's see exactly how far the money can do for you. There was a guy that was very wealthy. He said, one thing I know for certain, I'll never die of starvation. He had so much money. Put his faith in money. A few days later, he got locked into one of his vaults, and he died of starvation. He probably died of dehydration. But the point is, God said, oh, you want to put your faith in money? Okay, let's see how far the money can get you. When a person comes to pray to Borei Olam, what is he saying to God? God, it's all you. You're in control. Nothing's going to happen without you. My efforts don't mean anything. My efforts are just to tire me out so I don't make sins when I come home. My effort is just in order to cover up the miracle that you're doing. So my efforts mean zero, but I got to do it. But I know it's all you. So God says, ah, you finally came around. You're not the same guy as you were yesterday that said, it's me, and it's my industry, and it's my understanding, and it's my prowess. So God says, you're a different person. Now you're putting your reliance on me, so God says, now I'll handle it for you. Now I'll take care of it for you. Now put it this way. Now you just connected yourself to an unlimited power that can open the doors to anything. Right? You're in the game again. So prayer changes not God's mind. Prayer changes the person. It changes his attitude. And once his attitude changes, then already Borei Olam acts with him differently. Now, it's a process. It's not overnight. It's a cycle. Like the more you pray, the more faith you have. The more faith you have, the more you pray. And then all of a sudden you start to see yourself saying, you know what? I can stay to the end of the prayer. Not so important. You know what? I'm not going to miss the shiur because I want to stay to the office a couple of hours later tonight. Nah, I can do it tomorrow. Your whole attitude will start to change where your faith will grow, and automatically, without having to be told, work less, work more, automatically you'll know, I don't need to do this. And ask people that in business. Somebody told me, God forbid, his son had a sickness and he was he's a big businessman. But that year he happened to be in the hospital a lot every day with his kid. And he said, I can't figure it out, Rabbi. But I was not in the office half as much as I was the year before. And this was our best year ever. It could be one of two things. Could be that this guy's better off that he's not in the office because he doesn't know what he's doing, so it's better to keep him out. Let everybody else do their job. Therefore, probably, if that's the case, it's better off he just retires and the business will probably triple next year. And the other answer is that this man was really a successful person. He was a capable person. But he was testifying that, funny thing, I worked half the amount. Not because I wanted to work half the amount, just that's the way it was. I had no choice. And I was in the office as much as I can, and it just worked out. What's the logic? Because that year, he relied on God. He said, God, you got to help me out. I'm not here. Also, God says, all right, you're relying on me now. So now, the year before, you thought you were doing it yourself. So therefore, you got a certain amount. But once you pronounced who's in control, somebody olam comes through. This is already the subjects that we're talking about, bitachon and ishtadlut. Last but not least, we just have to remind yourself what the word bitachon means. I know we said the word faith tonight. There's two schools of thought what faith is. One school of thought says, whatever you want in life, if you have enough faith, you'll get it. Guy standing on the corner, he needs to get to Philadelphia. So if he has enough faith that he'll get to Philadelphia, some guy will stop and say, by the way, do you need to lift to Philadelphia? Hop in and he'll get there. It's like a charm. There was one rabbi that said that in a class. The student heard it. He said, great, I have 100% bitachon that I'm going to win the lotto tonight. And he went, he bought a ticket and he said, what are you doing? This is the winning ticket of lotto. I won, finished. He called his lawyer already. Prepared the papers. He called his accountant. How much tax do I have to pay on this money? He called already the real estate broker. Buy me this house. Already, I won. So the rabbi heard what this kid, student did. He said, well, this kid's going to be in for a big surprise when he doesn't win. So I better prove it to him that he's not going to win before he makes a fool out of him in the class. So he went to him. He said, what do you have in your hand? He said, the winning ticket. Winning ticket. How much is it worth? He said, $1 million. He said, I'll give you $500,000 for that ticket right now. He says, deal. He says, you must not believe that. Why would you sell me a ticket worth $1 million for $500,000? Hold on to this ticket tomorrow morning, you'll have $1 million. Why sell tonight? It means you don't believe. So therefore, they say, those that have 100% pitachon, it'll happen. Hazon Ish didn't agree with that type of understanding of pitachon. Hazon Ish was against it. Hazon Ish said it's a mistake. Hazon Ish said pitachon simply means that whatever God does is for the best. Which means you have to believe that anything that happens in your life was preordained by God and He knows what He's doing and it's for the best and it's for the good. That's what bitachon means. Not that I could have so much bitachon that it'll happen automatically. Well, you're not in control of God. I think they tell a story of the Hazon Ish. Somebody came to him and said, one doctor said to take an operation. It was a brain operation, Haman HaSilan. And the other doctor said, no, Sakana, do not take the brain operation. So I came to Hazon Ish, what do we do? He thought for a minute, he says, bring a third doctor. He asked the third doctor. The third doctor said, take the operation. They came to Hazon Ish, they said, alright, the third one said, take it, what do we do? He thought, he said, take it. They took it. Patient died. It doesn't usually end that way. This is a real story. So they went back to the Hazon Ish. They said, what happened? He says, what happened? That's what God wanted. But what do you mean? You said to take the operation. He says, yes. We made the proper hishtadlut. We made the proper decision. We have doctors. You go with the majority. We did our due diligence. But just because we made our effort does not mean that God now is automatically do what we want. God's will was that he's not going to live. But we're not guilty of that. We did what we were supposed to do. We made a proper decision using the proper calculations. We didn't recklessly make a decision, but the will of God is the will of God. And bitachon is no matter what happens to know, God is behind that decision and it's correct and it's right and it's for the best. And therefore, the lesson of tonight's class is, in short, the way to work on bitachon is to work on prayer. It's interesting. Work is called avodah, and prayer is called avodah. The way you work on that is, in practical terms, probably go buy yourself an English-Hebrew siddur, so you can understand what you're praying. Today we have some very good anthologies on explaining what the prayers mean. If you read a page or two a week even, it'll make all the difference in the world on your tefillot. And then you'd go and you'd start putting yourself in the faith prayer cycle. You pray, and the prayer reinforces your faith, and once you have more faith, you want to pray more, and you want to be in the synagogue more, and you realize that the decisions are made in the synagogue in prayer, and they're not made in the altar, and then all of a sudden, slowly, slowly, you'll see your priorities changing, and you'll start doing what you're supposed to. You won't have to be told. You know, those people ask, Rabbi, how much hours should I work? They're not there. Because you know, it's an automatic, once you start the process, you'll know already that you don't miss a class, and you won't feel it's a question anymore. You'll know how clear it is that God's in control, that the other question is not a question. It's only someone that's not there yet asks that question. How much? Means you didn't taste what pitachon is yet. Once you start tasting what pitachon is already, then you're able to calculate. And that's really the message. Bezat Hashem, if we can make the proper minimal ishtadlut as we can, and the maximum amount of faith that's demanded upon us. Again, faith is not always good in all situations. Lady leaves a baby on the windowsill. When the baby falls out the window, Rahman al-Siram, the mother says, yeah, that's what God wanted. Menashamayim. That's not Menashamayim. That lady's a murderer. So she can't blame her negligent behavior on God. That's a case where you don't use imunah and bitachon. That already was negligence. But Be'ezat Hashem, if we could use our judgment the right way, go to work according to the right amount of time, and then work on our imunah simultaneously, Be'ezat Hashem, Borei Olam will give us a beracha, Borei Olam will give us parnasah, anxiety-free, stress-free, and we'll be able to devote our time for the real priority, which is Hayei Nesach, which is the eternal life. We'll be able to pass all our tests that Borei Olam puts in front of us. B'ezrat Hashem, we'll go mechayim el chayim.